Matt Harrison, Chris Rosebrough, Aaron Wolf, Peter Bender, Todd Peppercorn, and Terry Mattingly will be speaking at the 2017 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, June 9th and Saturday, June 10th in Collinsville, Illinois, about 15 miles east of St. Louis. Registration is $120. For more information, visit issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 9th and 10th in Collinsville, Illinois. issuesetc.org.
Well, a Florida pastor walked out of President Trump's weekend rally calling it demonic. He says that his 11-year-old daughter was traumatized and in tears. And Pastor Joel Tooley is joining us live now to share his story. He is the lead pastor at First Church of the Nazarene in Melbourne, Florida. And just to set the stage for this, Pastor Joel, Donald Trump is not your cup of tea, but you wanted to go anyways so that your daughter would have the experience of seeing a presidential event. Tell us about that and tell us what happened.
Well, first of all, to clarify, I didn't describe the event as demonic. There was some
A headline described it as that.
Right. There was some people that were interacting that acted very angrily, and I described that interaction as
you
demonic.
You described some of the...
That's Pastor Joel Tooley, a Florida pastor being interviewed by CNN because he posted something on Facebook after going to a presidential rally, a Trump rally. The experience there, he said, was less than pleasant. He did use the word demonic, but how did he use the word demonic? More importantly, how did this story get on CNN? How did it get in the headlines of the Washington Post and become international news? Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're going to talk about a Washington Post story about this Florida pastor's experience at a Trump rally. Terry Mattingly will join us. He's senior fellow for media and religion at the King's College in New York City, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion, and he's founder and editor of GetReligion.org. Terry, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Glad to be here.
The Washington Post story that I first mistook for fake news when I saw it on my newsfeed, I think in Twitter, about a demonic mood or influence or something at a Trump rally. It was a Washington Post story. Was its subject even news?
Well, it says a lot that I heard about this story through an email from a journalism education colleague of mine who lives in New Zealand, you know, who picked up, you know, saw this thing in the New Zealand newspaper. A demonic activity palpable, says pastor at Trump rally. It obviously was not just news, it was obviously global news if it's receiving major play in New Zealand. And if you you do a search for certain relevant terms, it's apparent that this story is now everywhere. But it's everywhere because editors at the Washington Post considered it news. Now, I think it's careful to walk through this. At Get Religion, the post I put up on this topic, I led off with what I call a mirror image concept, which is where you stop and think if something had happened under the opposite circumstances, would it have been news? So I asked readers to flash back in time to 4 years ago. President Obama is doing a rally and to rev up his base, and at the end of this rally, one minister from an average to middle in size, normal local church, one minister goes on to Facebook and writes a highly critical post about the rally, which includes language that could be interpreted as saying that there was a demonic mood at the rally. Now, what I didn't know until I actually read the Facebook post is that that isn't even what the pastor actually said. So you've got several issues going on here at the same time. One is a single Facebook post by a single pastor who at the time the story was written was not available for comment. So all you have is the Facebook post itself. Is the presence of that post containing the word demonic in reference to having something to do with the Trump rally, is that international news? Would it have been international news 4 years ago if a pastor who was critical of Obama had gone to an Obama rally and said they sensed either A, something like a demonic presence, or B, that they sensed that this Obama rally was painting him to be some kind of Messiah, some sort of civil religion Jesus. Once again, I can't stress this too much. It might be interesting to find out if lots of people who attended the rally felt that way. It might be interesting to call the minister up and do a story about why he felt this way, what other ministers who were at the rally felt. In other words, if you took that Facebook point as a post as a launching point, there might be an interesting story here about how divided we've become as a nation, how bitter the conflicts have become. And this Facebook post could be, oh, the anecdotal lead on an interesting story. But is it a story all by itself at global news level? That's the question.
So it could be, you know, the like you say, the anecdotal lead to a greater story, to a bigger story. But answer your question. Is a single pastor, whether it's Obama or Trump, is a single pastor who has attended a presidential rally, posting about it on Facebook, whatever his thoughts may be, is that Washington Post headline newsworthy?
Well, it is if the Washington Post is primarily attempting to drive mouse clicks online with an audience that predisposed to think that there would be demonic activity at a Trump rally. In other words, this is a great hook for a clickbait headline. Now, whether or not this treated the actual comments of this pastor fairly and accurately is another question altogether. After I had posted this, I was pointed toward a CNN interview that the pastor had given. And the very first thing the person on CNN says is, attending a rally that had, you know, a demonic rally or a rally that had demonic influences. And they cut to the pastor, and the very first words out of his mouth were, first of all, I did not describe the event as demonic. Now, let's pause for a second. What did the man actually say? Now, this pastor, apparently, if you read his Facebook posts, this pastor is apparently someone who politically is exactly where I am. He was a never Trump, never Hillary person. He's highly critical of Trump. He found the kind of church-state symbolism of the rally kind of disturbing, like people chanting USA, USA, USA after they said the Lord's Prayer. Or Pentecostal believers raising their hands into the air in praise while singing the country classic, God Bless the USA. There were elements of this rally that he found a little creepy. I would have to say that if I had been there, I would have found them just as creepy. So I'm now more sympathetic to this guy. Now, the actual presence of the word demonic, I read the whole Washington Post piece, and I tried to figure out, how did he use that term? And it's not in the story. It's in the lead, but nowhere else in the story does it show you the context for his use of the term demonic. And that's because he wasn't describing the rally. He was describing a conflict that occurred between two anti-Trump demonstrators who were, according to him, very calmly demonstrating, and they had brought their own children. And then a small group of Trump fans began harassing these people, telling them to, you know, calling for the police to come move them out, trying to get them to shut up, trying to shout them down. And a pretty ugly scene commences, at which point, when someone tries to move one of the women and her daughter, the pastor kind of steps in. Now, you've got Trump fans shouting at the pastor in the foulest of possible language, even though he's standing there with his 11-year-old daughter. And he describes the face of one of the people screaming at him as showing evidence of the demonic that made him feel like there was some sort of demonic hatred involved in this scene. Now, if you keep reading, other Trump supporters, other people at the rally, immediately then begin to come in and move in to help him and to help shield the people so they're not hurt, to protect them. So the whole picture of the rally now is more complex. You've got this kind of creepy church-state rally. Then you've got really angry protesters, and the most angry ones are shouting down anti-Trump. And then you've got Trump rally participants who behave in a very civil and tolerant manner in the spirit of this pastor to step in and try to prevent the situation from getting out of control. Now, when you have all of that, and the word demonic is only used to describe that bitter encounter between a few protesters and these anti-Trump protesters, is it accurate to describe that as Trump rally, demonic activity palpable, says Pastor?
Terry Mattingly is our guest. We're talking about that Washington Post story about a Florida pastor's experience at a President Trump rally. Should the headline simply have been, and nothing more than local news, local pastor harassed at Trump rally? Find out after this.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Messiah Lutheran, Seattle, Washington. Grace Lutheran, McPherson, Kansas. St. Paul's Lutheran, Bridgeport, Nebraska. Our Savior Lutheran, Raleigh, North Carolina. St. Paul Lutheran, Hancock, Maryland. Messiah Lutheran, Keller, Texas. St. John's Lutheran, Maple Grove, Minnesota. Grace Lutheran, Parker, Colorado. And Our Redeemer Lutheran, Harrington, Kansas. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Go to our website, issuesetc.org, and click support. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll advertise your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. issuesetc.org, click support. The Issues Etc. 300.
Smartest listeners in radio. You're listening to Issues Etc.
College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois offers ACT, SAT, and PSAT test prep, scholarship application classes, college and career counseling, and more. Hi, this is Lori Konski, president of College Preparation Station. We have helped our students obtain more than $7 million in tuition scholarships in 12 years. Find out more at cpsprep.com. Let us help you create a vision and find your future. The College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois, cpsprep.com.
Metro East Lutheran High School in Edwardsville, Illinois, engages young adults in a Christ-centered environment, delivering academic excellence and spiritual growth to develop Christian leaders for tomorrow. We provide a Christ-focused alternative to public high schools. Many of our students receive tuition assistance. To help us provide tuition assistance to more students, go to melhs.org and click on the giving page, or call me, Dr. J. Krause, principal, at
618-656-0043. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Terry Mattingly of GetReligion.org is our guest. We're talking about the Washington Post story about a Florida pastor's experience at a President Trump rally. So, Terry, I'm not a journalist, but I am going to take a shot at just, if this is pure local news, if I'm a local journalist, the headline for me, the story for me is going to be local pastor harassed at Trump rally. You get your quotes, you get the story. That doesn't make national news. That doesn't make it to New Zealand.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's local news, though, even. Once again, without going into the story and talking to some other pastors who were present, for sure having a follow-up conversation with this pastor, I'm not sure you put this in social media promoted coverage that's going out to the world. I'm not sure you put it there. Well, in fact, I wouldn't put it there just based on this one Facebook post. And on top of that, you misinterpret the post at the level of the headline and the first sentence, the lead.
So if you're an editor at the Washington Post before this thing hits the presses or the button is punched to put it online, do you take out your big red pen and put an M at the top of the page for misleading?
Well, I mean, putting on my journalism professor hat, I think I would have written at the top, this story is incomplete. This is a fascinating topic. We're not running this until we talk to the minister and we talk to some other people at the rally. And maybe we even talk to, a historian or two that are experts on the history of civil religion and kind of God language in American politics. I could name you some great examples from multiple generations of people who study that kind of thing. Here's the key. Social media is a tremendous potential tool for reporting. I tell my students this all the time. Social media points you toward the existence of points of view and the existence of eyewitnesses that you never would have known about otherwise. But social media alone does not take the place of then following up with traditional journalism methodology that you use to find out what actually happened in this story. It doesn't exist like as its own thing that's worthy of coverage all by itself. Now, I can immediately then, I hear myself second guessing. I could see doing a sidebar to a story where you said, on Facebook, there were the following 10 reactions to this rally. And then you have like a collection of quotes from people that were there, all drawn from Facebook. I can see that working. That is not what happened in this case. I wondered, since this guy is an evangelical, I mean, the Nazarenes, the Church of the Nazarene, is an overwhelmingly evangelical to conservative denomination. And if you read his whole post, it's very clear that his views at this event were quite complex and that he was kind of going out of his way to be nuanced about some of this stuff, and that mainly he's upset about the bitterness that has soaked into our national life right now between the two sides. And that bitterness and anger is what he calls the demonic. So I'm wondering, you know, if something bad were to happen to this pastor in terms of his employment or his status in the denomination, you know, I don't know where the Nazarenes stand on Trump these days, but I would imagine there are some Trump supporters and probably a lot more people who were kind of caught in the middle politically, like this pastor clearly was. He made it very clear that he did not vote for either of the major candidates. What if this pastor got fired because of this headline, which clear in the social media viral story that kind of came out of it? Is it journalism to handle it in this manner? I don't think I've seen anything in a paper in quite a while that kind of got me as riled up for journalistic reasons as this particular weird story. But back to your original question, because I think this is what our listeners would be interested in. How do you decide what a story is anyway? And I think what most editors would say, we make our stories based on whether we feel the story's complete, but at the top of the list also, in this kind of location, location, location thing, we write stories that we really think our readers want to read, especially in this online age where the click of the mouse is everything, much more important than even how many subscribers you have. At that point, if the Washington Post has kind of, in its online persona, kind of declared itself the Breitbart of the cultural and political left, which at times I'm hearing people call it that, if they think this is what their readers want to read, if this is the point of view that their readers already have about President Trump, is it a story? You know they're going to click it. In kind of a ends justify the means journalism, is this a story? it probably is.
Do you think the recipe went something like this in the Washington Post thinking, okay, Trump is president largely because evangelicals voted for him. A lot of them held their nose, but he did have enthusiastic evangelical support, especially from prominent evangelical leaders. Here's a pastor, an evangelical, didn't vote for him and feels a demonic presence at his thing. That's got to be a story. I mean, it's just because evangelicals love Trump, we found the dog that didn't bark or something like that?
Well, you just hinted, though, at what the actual valid story was. I mean, we know from exit polls and stuff that about half the people, half of the white evangelicals who voted for Trump didn't want to vote for Trump. They were voting against Hillary Rodham Clinton. Once again, that formula that you and I have discussed before that I heard over and over, I don't know a single person in my own personal life and at my church, I'm Eastern Orthodox, not fundamentalist or evangelical Christian, I don't know a single person in my personal life who wanted to vote for Donald Trump. Not a single one. Now, I know many people who did vote for Donald Trump. I did not. I didn't vote for either candidate, much like this pastor in Florida. So at the very least, based on the facts, if evangelicals were one of the primary groups of people who elected Trump, even though, by the way, Rust Belt Democrats and probably marginal Catholics in the Midwest are the people who actually gave him his Electoral College victory, but you can parentheses that. Back to the evangelicals. If half the evangelicals wanted to vote for him and half the evangelicals didn't want to vote for him, but they held their nose and did, that makes this rally in Florida potentially a very interesting story. What if instead of just taking something off Facebook, if you actually had someone at the rally and you deliberately tried to interview evangelicals in both of those camps? What if you tried to interview people who were really there because they love Trump? That's one point of view. But do you think that any of those other evangelicals might have come out for the rally kind of with the, okay, he's president of the United States now. What do I think now? Might there have been clergy there who fit into that reluctant Trump camp that pulled the lever for him but did it while biting my lip, voter? I mean, in other words, you could have done a very interesting story here. But that would have also have meant paying to send a reporter to the rally. Isn't it just a lot easier to watch it on streaming video and then look online at social media and then write a story about that? But once again, you've let technology replace the actual journalistic work of covering the rally and talking to people who were there, including trying to find, if you're going to make evangelicals the story and this demonic thing is your deal, what if you actually talked to people about that? It's so tempting to take the social media role. It's cheaper. It's quicker. Social media creates social media. It's going to produce clicks. Hey, what's to lose?
Let's talk a little bit about social media. I'm looking at the pastor's Facebook page right now. And now I assume his follower numbers have probably shot up since this appeared yesterday in the Washington Post. So, and online. But he's got 3,700, someone shy of 3,700 followers on his Facebook page. Now, that's not a lot for a pastor if he's pastor of a large congregation and then has a network of other pastors and things like that. That's not a lot for a pastor. How do you think this particular Facebook post found its way onto the screen of a Washington Post reporter? I mean, the ability of social media to unrealistically magnify something like a single post from a pastor. Talk about that.
Now, that's a great question. And I assume that to some degree, the post must have gone viral down in Florida and then somebody from the Post saw it somewhere, or somebody forwarded one of the posts to a reporter, you know, at the Washington Post. That's a great question. I really don't know how that went down.
See, to me, that's a source issue as a journalist.
It's a sourcing issue. But once again, it points toward an interesting source that you didn't know existed. And you wouldn't have known existed without social media, or maybe if the local paper had somehow picked up on this. But it's not like this guy is a national figure. In my post, I mentioned that if a pastor of a prominent church or an officer at a major denomination had written this post and put it up at, say, a national website of the Assemblies of God or the national website of the National Association of Evangelicals or the national website of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention. I mean, if this had been posted in a national forum, at that point, if I was on the beat today, writing daily stories as opposed to writing a weekly column, I would immediately have said, oh my gosh, this is really interesting. We have to call some people and get their reactions to this post, and let's do a story. But do you see what I put back into the mix? I put follow-up reporting and context back into the mix. Also, if you had actually called this pastor up and got him on the phone, and maybe he went into hiding briefly before he decided this thing has gotten so big, I'm going to have to talk somebody, I'll choose CNN. You know, I don't know. I don't know what happened. You know that if you got this man on the phone, the very first words out of his mouth would be, I didn't call the event demonic. But who did call the event demonic? The Washington Post. So isn't this kind of like a vicious cycle?
Terry Mattingly is our guest. We'll have a few more minutes with him on the other side of the break on this Thursday, February the 23rd, talking about a Washington Post story about a Florida pastor's experience at a President Trump rally. When we come back, this is all in the context, of course, of a twittering president who drives the news cycle with every tweet. Terry, by the way, will be one of the speakers at one of our conferences, the Issues Etc. Making the Case conferences, the one that's held Friday, June the 9th and Saturday, June the 10th, 2017, here in Collinsville, Illinois. He'll be speaking alongside President Matt Harrison of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, Pastor Todd Peppercorn, Aaron Wolf of Chronicles Magazine, Chris Rose, bro of Fighting for the Faith, and Pastor Peter Bender of the Concordia Catechetical Academy. That's Friday, June the 9th and Saturday, June the 10th, 2017 at Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Collinsville, Illinois. The cost of the conference is $120 and includes three meals. Attendance, as usual, is limited to 400 people, and you can register at issuesetc.org or give us a call, 618-223-8385. That's the Issues Etc. Making the Case conference, the first one of 2017, Friday, June the 9th and Saturday, June the 10th at Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Collinsville, Illinois. When we come back, more with Terry Mattingly. Stay tuned.
Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Collinsville, Illinois is happy to support the Christ-centered, cross-focused ministry of Issues Etc. Join us for worship, Bible classes, youth ministry, and other opportunities to grow in Christ. We have a Christian day school for children in preschool to 8th grade. We are located at 1300 Beltline Road. Call us at 618-344-3151 or visit www.goodshepherdcollinsville.org.
Are you tired of working nights, weekends, and odd hours trying to cover your bases at home just to make ends meet? At the Cleaning Authority, we call that the multi-job shuffle, and we want to end that for you right now. We'll train you in our proven, efficient cleaning methods, and you'll be partnered to work in pre-qualified homes. Call 314-416-8117 and walk away from the multi-job shuffle with a future in our St. Louis office. 314-416-8117.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about a Washington Post story about a Florida pastor's experience at a President Trump rally. Terry Mattingly is our guest. In a few minutes, we'll be talking with Dr. Mark Burkholz about Matthias the Apostle. He is, well, he's not among the original apostles. He's the replacement for Judas. Was that a mistake? We'll answer that question right off the bat. Then Ashley McGuire will join us, author of the book Sex Scandal, The Drive to Abolish Male and Female. We'll talk about President Trump's rescinding of the rules on bathrooms for transgendered students. Terry, of course, everything we've been talking about up to this point is taking place in the context of a news cycle that I think we might say lives and dies by the president's tweets. When he tweets, it makes national news. And I imagine for a journalist like yourself, that's positively bizarre.
Well, it certainly has changed the process. And this is one of the reasons why it's so controversial that Trump continues to use Twitter to the degree that he does, because it's put the cart in front of the horse as far as the viewpoint of the media. The president is supposed to say things in normal journalistic context, and then the media gets to produce the quick, snappy version that goes out to the American people. Trump, in forcing them to, in effect, write sound bites about his sound bites, has disrupted the whole pattern. But of course, he's president today because this worked for his complete advantage during the primaries and allowed him, with the full cooperation of the mainstream press, to knock off infinitely more qualified GOP candidates, if you're looking at traditional political qualifications. He's president today because of his skill at this disruptive communications. But now the shoe is on the other foot, because what happened, and the media never ever thought it would happen, he became president. So now he's supposed to play by their rules all of a sudden? I don't think he wants to do that or has any intention of doing that.
Terry, do you remember the quaint old days when the media complained about Ronald Reagan getting past them as gatekeepers by going on television or giving a speech or even holding a press conference?
Oh, of course. And the fact that he was funny, and the fact that to some degree Peggy Noonan, who used to write sound bites for Dan Rather and then began writing sound bites for Ronald Reagan, the fact that Peggy Noonan was good at communicating to normal people. And then, according to Noonan, Reagan would pick up a pencil and begin editing her copy. And that many of his most famous one-liners as president, she said he wrote them in the margins. Reagan knew what sounded was good in his own voice. So the fact that you had a professional communicator serving in the ultimate communications position, that upset the media at that time. A member of my own family recently made a wisecrack. He said, now, this would not be what Trump does, but what if Trump began giving fireside chats like FDR? And on top of his tweets, once a week, he just sat down at a microphone and talked for 20 minutes. Once again, he would be putting his own words in their own context out there. And today we live in the age of podcasting, internet radio, all kinds of independent talk radio stations. We live in the age of digital radio, like things like Lutheran Public Radio exist. How far would Trump's words go if he started doing a 15-minute podcast a week? I think it's a really interesting time when the very fragmentation of the media that's causing so much problems in terms of advertising and economics and whatever, this same technological fragmentation is causing media problems in actually doing their job in terms of reporting the news. It's giving them new tools, but it's giving them this rebellion president who has a whole new set of tools and toys in his political workbox, toolbox. It's a very, very interesting and confused age. And what I wish is that we could use these new technologies as a way to gather more information, but not stop using the traditional tools of editing, verification, calling people to get other points of view and other alternative voices. In other words, I think all of this social media and stuff could be adding to our journalism. Right now, it seems to be driving our journalism. And I'm very worried about that.
Terry Mattingly, a senior fellow for media and religion at the King's College in New York City, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion. He's founder and editor of GetReligion.org. Terry, thanks for being our guest.
Glad to be here.
Right there in the first chapter of the book of Acts, near the end of that first chapter, we have an interesting account of tying up of loose ends. It's hard to tell, but kind of out of the blue, Peter and the other apostles come to the conclusion that the absent seat among them, that empty seat, that empty spot left by Judas, who had betrayed Jesus, needs to be filled. They do so with a man named Matthias. The church remembers him on the 24th of February. We'll do so on the other side of the break with Dr. Mark Burkholz of Concordia University, Chicago. Stay tuned.
We would like to overlook the difficulty of daily repentance and death to our sins in the interest of progressing to a more advanced spirituality.
Rebecca Curtis from her new audiobook, Ladylike, Living Biblically.
Somehow, spiritual advancement always amounts to our getting to spend more time on the things we like and calling it stewardship or service.
You can purchase and download an audio version of Ladylike, Living Biblically at Amazon, Audible, and iTunes. Ladylike, Living Biblically by Rebecca Curtis and Rose Adel.
I'm not a Christian, but I listen to your show because actually you do have some interesting topics.
Here's a recent comment from the Issues Etc. comment line.
Do you believe that there's not one error in the Bible? That's intellectually infantile. You also believe that Jesus is coming again. You promote extremely sexually repressive views.
The Issues Etc. comment line, available 24/7, 618-223-8382.
Have fun waiting for Jesus to return. Got news for you. He ain't coming back.
We're supported by listeners like you. You're listening to Issues Etc.
This is Pastor Donald Jordan welcoming you to Redeemer Evangelical Lutheran Church in Chico, California. We stand upon the inspired, inerrant Word of God and preach Jesus Christ and Him crucified. Students at Chico State and Butte College are welcome to our college group. Our divine service is at 10 and Sunday school at 9. We are located at 750 Moss Avenue, and our website is RedeemerChico.org.
Come listen to Drs. Alvin Schmidt and Roland Elke at the 3rd Annual Concordia Apologetics Conference, Cultures in Collision, Faith and a Fractured World, this March 3rd and 4th at Concordia University, Wisconsin. You can register online at www.cuw.edu/apologetics or call 262-243-4343. That's the Concordia Apologetics Conference, March 3rd and 4th at Concordia University, Wisconsin.